impression someone will tell me just let it go, you know?
Yeah.
Have another few day-night stays here in the high mountains. Welcome to other riders. Ride home.
In this edition of the Transcontinental Race Podcast, we bring you stories of the anguish the riders face on the road. You heard Bjorn Lennard pushing his bike up the steepest climb in Poland on the way to Control Point 3. When he arrived, he told race coordinator Juliana Böhring about the pain of his past 48 hours.
I never had really such a low point in my life. I cannot say it different. It's the heat was okay because of the wind. And then I came into a bigger city and I went through it, it was okay. And then I went to the big road. And this was for 10 kilometers, it was okay. I mean, you had a big side, a hard shoulder, you know? And I mean, I feel safe on this. And then this stopped. There was none. And it was really, it's impossible to ride there. So I decided, okay, let's get off there. So it turned right. And then it was saying, okay, let's do kind of zigzag, just on the same route I have. And next, I want to go left. Roadworks, completely closed, impossible to ride there. So you can just keep going. So then I was saying, okay, well, if I keep going, I get onto the track. What I want to go back today. So I came there, and this is also a, let's say, a main road. I run out of food and drinks because this, all these small minutes, you don't get anything. Then you see something, oh, you can pay with coins, but not with euro, not with Visa. And then I think it was six or so, I was completely dead.
Oh, God.
I was sitting there, it was, I could have stopped crying. This was the next step, you know, it was just right in front of it.
I could totally feel you right now.
You know, I was sitting there. I mean, I was still in first position, you know, but
I know. Oh, God.
And then, you know, I had a quick phone call with my girlfriend and I decided, well, I need something to eat now and something to sleep. This was just, you try to, what can I do now?
Oh, gosh, I'm so
sorry. Oh, sorry.
It's gonna get better. It's gonna get better. Get you some food.
That's life, yeah. Let's see if they have some cake at the end.
They've got something for sure.
The roads that had looked so sensible to Bjorn when he mapped them from the comfort of his home grew busy. His reroutes were meandering or unusable. And as we heard, after a day of frustration, when he finally pulled in for food, he couldn't use his card to buy it. But things still weren't getting easier for Bjorn.
At least it's all downhill from here. Yeah. You have a long downhill.
No, not yet.
Not yet?
Not yet.
You get to go back down the hill, don't you? You got a puncture.
Oh, no.
I managed to cut off the sidewall.
No. When did that happen? Just now? On the
2 kilometers
climb?
Away from here.
Oh, God. Oh, no. That's what happened.
So, anyway, I got it fixed. Pumped it up. And then I dismounted the brake. And all I have from that is... But the rest is inside. To run a tubeless again, you need a big pressure point. So.
He began trying to fix his tubeless tire. Then managed to track down a compressor. And he fixed the puncture.
I don't believe this shit.
Thank
you. Come on. We fixed it in the middle of nowhere. It's unbelievable. And you know, I mean, you hear the compressor here.
Yeah.
I mean, ask someone else here if they have a compressor in the middle of nowhere. Oh. This is like this is all you can do about it.
or the sad or crying. So yeah.
I mean, you can step down and take the bus and drive home, you know? And cry. This is crazy.
The next morning at the control point, we were sat watching the tracking dots of riders approaching, waiting for the lead pair in the race, Cap 253A James Craven and Cap 253B Jonathan Rankin, to arrive. But we only saw one orange jersey grinding up the climb rather than two. It was Jonathan riding without James.
He's not feeling well. So I think I'm going to get this down and then whilst
okay.
We're doing this.
Well. So you're soloing now then, for sure?
I don't want to put words in his mouth. Last night we stopped at what, 7 o'clock or something. Had a wash, got some food, and then slept until 5 this morning. And he's just, like all of yesterday afternoon, he was just dead, like we were crawling along. And he was like on my wheel, and then he'd be off at the back, and then we'd go and get him again. And then he was just not able to think straight, really. And he's got this cough as well. So basically, he's in a hotel. He's going to stay there for the whole day. I'm actually going back, not the way I came, but through the same town. So I might text him to see if he's okay. But I would say that I'm going solo.
So we'll let the team know you're not a pair anymore.
Yeah.
All right.
There are advantages to riding in a pair. There's the company, there's the sharing of kit, and you're allowed to draft behind your partner to escape the wind, which solo riders aren't allowed to do if they meet. This means that if a pair splits, then they can't become solo riders in the general classification because they've enjoyed these advantages that other solo riders in the race haven't. They're allowed to carry on, but when they finish, their place isn't listed in the ranking. They're just classified as a finisher. At the control, Jonathan couldn't have his brevet card stamped without James being there, but James had a chest infection and suspected pneumonia.
When I said, like, Johnny, I'm not doing good, he understood straight away. And actually on day four, it was kind of almost the reverse. So Johnny struggled a bit early on in the day. He had to stop for a sleep. He was struggling to keep up. And so I think going through that process the day before and having Johnny on the back foot, I think helped for him to recognise that something was wrong with me. It is hard because I guess your bodies are doing different things and it's hard to know if that person's just not pulling their weight or whatever, or if something is actually going wrong. But I knew something was up. I waited for a bit, I cycled for like maybe 20 kilometres, and then I talked to Johnny and I said there's a few options, like I know I need to stay at a hotel and see how I feel tomorrow. You can either crack on and I'll meet you at the checkpoint, maybe if I'm feeling good the next day I can get up early and try and catch you up.
He said, I'm going to have a sleep. I'm going to stop in a 55k or whatever. Have a rest, have proper breakfast, have dinner. And our plan had been to get here last night. And he said, you go off ahead. And we were riding and I was thinking in my head, I'm not racing as a single, right? I'm still racing as a pair until he actually scratches. Or until he actually really decides that he's going to stop rather than kind of half deciding. So then we both stopped and I just sort of treated it as an excuse to have a proper rest. And if he was fine, we were, you know, still racing as a pair. But then this morning he took the pleasure of waking me up at 4 o'clock in the morning to tell me that he was feeling even worse. And I said, that's fine, James, I'll talk to you in the morning. I'm going back to sleep. And then when I got up in the morning, he was just a broken man.
I had a temperature, dripping with sweat. I was trying to stay positive and think, like, yeah, I'm not that bad. But yeah, yesterday was a struggle. Just no energy to do anything. Like, yeah, it was just that was a tough day, just getting out of bed and going to a hospital as well. I had to cycle there, and yeah, it took me about 3 hours to actually get anything done.
This morning when I was walking out the door, he said, you know, I still want to ride to Greece, I'm just not sure I could make it up this hill. As in, like, the one right outside our hotel. Tomorrow he'll make a decision, I think.
For Johnny, it's probably much better for him just to push on and have his own race. And obviously Johnny's trained so hard for this and spent so long thinking about the race. I knew he wanted it to finish in a good position, and so I think we talked about it a bit, but not. I think he probably made the best decision, because he probably would have been more stressful for me if he was just waiting around and just waiting for me to recover, not knowing when he could start again. So,
but you say about Johnny having done all the training and prep, presumably that's exactly the same for you, so it must be hard for you.
Yeah, of course, yeah. I mean, that's why I don't want to throw in the towel just yet, because I would like to finish the race, so yeah. Been thinking about it for quite a long time. And
have you spoken to your family? Do they know that you...
Yeah, they do, and yeah, it's hard, because like family and girlfriend, some say, and no, you won't give up, keep on going. Some are like, oh no, you just like, you've got pneumonia. Knowing what to do is hard, because I could start cycling and just make it a whole lot worse, or it could be fine, I don't know. So it's hard, and I guess no one knows really how you're feeling and what you're thinking. Like yesterday, I was trying to tell myself that I was fine, but I was struggling to get to the hospital, and it was so hot, and like, felt so ill. Like, I was just thinking that most people I know probably wouldn't even get out of bed to go to work feeling like that, but I knew I just had to sort myself out. And yeah,
as the riders spread further and further from one another as the race goes on, there can be moments when you need something to lift your spirits on the road. Daniel Brayson rode last year's transcontinental race and passed on some pearls of wisdom.
There was actually a point in the race where I was checking the track leaders, and there was a group that was ahead of me that was like a leaders group, and then there was a group that was behind me, and I was kind of like caught in no man's land. I was like the only rider around me for like a good distance, and obviously I was following this chasing pack, and they were too far ahead for me to catch up, and these guys behind weren't catching me up. So I went 3 days last year's race of never seeing a single rider. Now, I thought that for me was quite unusual, in the sense that, you know, I imagined other people would be seeing lots of riders all the time. But then you get to the finish line and you speak to James Hayden, and he's like, yeah, I didn't see anyone, because obviously he's mostly just out front. He's like, I didn't see anyone for days and days and days. And so, you know, you kind of appreciate, okay, oh yeah, you know, if you want to do well, or if, you know, this is what it's all about. It's all about spending that time alone. I think you have to have strategies. I think, again, it's all about finding ways for you to cope with that. I'm really good with just being alone with my thoughts, and I find it quite therapeutic, you know. But there's a limit. And so what I would do is I would have podcasts. I would have music that I really liked, and if I was like, you know, if I wasn't going up any hills and I could sing along, I would sing along just to, you know, with the music, if it wasn't going to use up too much energy, just because I felt that was quite a cathartic thing to do. One schoolboy error that I made was I downloaded this book called I, Partridge, which is the biography of Alan Partridge, right? And I would listen to that, and I was laughing a lot, which you think would be a good thing, because laughing's good. But if you're cycling your bike and you're already struggling to breathe, laughing is not a good thing. So I started listening to that, got half an hour in, was in stitches, literally in stitches, because I was struggling to breathe and laughing. So I had to basically just chalk that one off as a bit of experience, and never to put anything funny on there again. But at least whilst I'm riding, you know, I guess in the moments of downtime, then you could listen to something like that. But yeah, don't put anything funny on there. Just put something interesting on there.
I'd love to have seen Daniel Brayson covered in a few days of dirt and wheezing along, laughing to himself as he made his way across the continent. Our final stories come from Control Point 4, where the gravel climb up to the top of the mountain requires a bit of a sense of humour, because it's one of the roughest climbs we've ever had in a parkour at the Transcontinental. But as Bjorn Lennard approached, there wasn't much for him to laugh about. After all the emotion of his journey to Control Point 3, he'd fought back a lot of the deficit between himself and James Hayden. One setback from James and he could be within a shot of passing him. But then, as the light darkened, he was on what appeared to be the most direct road to Control Point 4, but the road surface began to crumble away into a jagged track, a route that his pro racing tyres were never meant to see. Eventually, in the dark, he made the decision to retrace his steps and add 160 kilometres to his journey to reach the control. When he met race director Anna Haslock, he was almost inconsolable.
But the thing is, you get there, then you have gravel. I mean, I don't mind about gravel, you know? So, okay, down a bit, and I was up at 700 metres already. And it would have been going up to 1200. And the thing is, my sleeping bag is not ready for this.
No. And what time
was it? 10 in the evening. And it was already cold. So I turned back on. And then the guys told me, yeah, this road is closed in 20 years. There is a way to go around, but the big stuff.
Yeah.
You know, you see 120 kilometers to checkpoint 4. And now I have done today 255. Mm. Plus the 20 I went down yesterday in the evening. 200 additional kilometers.
Sorry, ma'am.
Oh.
It'll be funny eventually. I know it's not funny now.
Stefan Owaja, Cap 12, had arrived just before Bjorn, and his journey had its trials too.
Instantly when I entered Bosnia, I knew that nothing's going to be well.
He'd tried to get a hotel near the Bosnian border, but nowhere had a room for him. Eventually, he found a coach station and there was a man there with a coffee and a newspaper. So Stefan asked if he knew anywhere. He did, but he wasn't in any hurry to help him out.
I was waiting, and during the night, the time is even more precious. Every single minute you could sleep. And I was waiting. The guy was drinking his coffee.
Finally, the guy took him to a landlady who showed him around the worst hotel room he'd ever seen.
It was horrible. Every electric plug was dismantled. No sheet. Plenty of things that was so wrong in the hotel. And then he said, yeah, 10 euros. Okay, 10 euros, no problem. He said, cash money. No, it's not over. The problem continued.
He didn't have.
And then he said, yeah, you have a cash machine. Far away, 500 meters, so I had to take my bike right to the cash machine. When I arrived at the cash machine, I put my card into it and said, yeah, transaction temporarily not available. No, not possible, no! I took my bike, rushed into the room, took all my stuff. Okay, fuck this shit, I'm out.
Battered but not broken, we wished Bjorn and Stefan luck as they set off to climb the 2,000 metres over gravel and rock to the top of Bosnia's Bjenolika mountain. Once an Olympic skiing run, it was closed down during the Bosnian War that began in 1992 and now lies dilapidated and crumbling, a fearsome ascent that will be one of the decisive parkours of this year's transcontinental race.
Anna?
Yeah?
Next time, please, with thunderstorms out here.
Okay.
And some snow, maybe.
Got ya.
Make it really epic.
Not hard enough.
What kind of shit is this?